Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal and family well-being and everything that's going on in our greater environment. I'm a long-standing journalist of food, health, the environment, media, policies, and science. And we have a lot to talk about in these changing times, and I'm so delighted to have joining me today a returning guest who's been on our show. I think this is now the third time, and someone whom I regard as really a leader and pioneer in the understandings that I regularly present and work from, and that is Robert McChesney, professor of communications at the Center for Global Studies at Urbana, Illinois. And the author of multiple books. We've had him on several times for past books, including his most recent book, Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. Certainly a prescient topic that was published by the New Press in 2013. He came on to this program at that time. We're now, 4 years down the line from then, and his predictions have really been borne out. He also appeared here for an earlier book, Dollarocracy, written with John Nichols, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. I guess that sounds pretty prescient. Our theme on today's show, as the debate and firestorm around media in the past recent election and in the current administration just continues to amp up more and more. So glad to have you back with us today on Connect the Dots. Welcome back, Bob McChesney.
Well, thank you, Allison. And I should point out that John Nichols and I had a book that came out a few months ago in 2016 called People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy, published by Nation Books. So that actually is the new stuff.
Great. Well, everything that you have written about has, basically predicted where we are and where we're going and how and why the setup of our structures and systems is kind of driving us down these roads. I reached out to you to come back onto the show in the midst of the debacle over the coverage of the question of whether the Russians had hacked the recent presidential election. We're now a couple of months down the line from, that quagmire. We could begin by talking about that, because I know you were touring and sort of sorting that out for people, or just sort of jump into where we are now, which is, the media has not only been a driving factor, as you had predicted, in the distortions of the recent election, but is also, at the center of the firestorm in the current administration. So where should we begin and jump into this?
Well, we've got an hour, so let's cover everything. And probably the best way to do it is to start with the did Russia tamper with the American election? And if so, was Trump aware of it? Was he involved in it? Did he condone it? Was he part, some sort of Manchurian candidate type guy working with a foreign government? That is a really interesting question. And I think that it's been conflated with a lot of other sort of new Cold War sort of hostility towards Russia and discussion of how sleazy Putin is and the sort of autocratic nature of the Russian government and how they're sort of sleazeballs. And that sort of overrides the actual evidence for the Soviet intervention into the fall election. What we do know about the fall election is that the Russians, not Soviets, the Russians were accused of releasing a lot of the Democratic National Committee emails from Paul, whatever the guy's name is, who ran the DNC, who worked on Hillary, Hillary's
John
campaign.
John Podesta,
John Podesta, excuse me, thanks. Podesta's emails between the campaign and the Democratic National Committee, which showed that Hillary Clinton's campaign is working very closely with the Democratic National Committee against the rules of the DNC, by the way, so that the DNC would rig the process so that she would get the nomination. And this was very embarrassing for Hillary Clinton when this came out. No one doubted the veracity or truth of these emails. That was never a question. And she quickly said we shouldn't pay any attention to them because the Russians are responsible for releasing them, and therefore they're illegitimate for him to know about them, which was certainly an interesting argument she was making in that behalf. She didn't claim they weren't true. And what was most interesting about those emails, and the reason why they didn't get much attention was that they also showed how closely Hillary Clinton and the DNC worked with major news media to shape the news to be hostile to Bernie Sanders while she was running against him in favor of her campaign. In fact, it's almost embarrassing for the news media to see how close what these emails from Podesta reveal and from the DNC reveal. And how news media really were in bed with her, presenting her talking points routinely on CNN, MSNBC, Politico. The Washington Post basically was a house organ for the Clinton campaign throughout the Democratic nomination process. So the news media had no great incentive to go into that and cover themselves critically, so they jumped on the Russia story too. Now, there may well be stuff Russia did, and there may well be stuff Trump did that we don't know about, that the hard evidence hasn't still been shown. But to the extent it's based largely on those emails, or that's sort of their interference with the campaign, that they are accused of releasing factual emails that actually good journalists should have gotten themselves. It's very important information for voters to have. That seems like a pretty weak case against Russia, unless there's a lot more to it. And there may well be. And there may well be stuff about Trump's relationship with Russia and his business relationships, completely independent of this email stuff, to warrant concern and investigation and maybe illegal. But on the face of it, the idea that we should disregard what those emails showed because Russia was accused of releasing them and they weren't discovered by an American journalist doing their job, since none was actually doing their job on that issue, strikes me as sort of ludicrous on its face. As you're about to discover, I'm no fan of Trump whatsoever. But mm-hmm. I think also, we have to be at least factually accurate and honest here. And the campaign to sort of railroad Russia as being responsible for Hillary Clinton's defeat seems misguided. I might also add, if we would want to look at foreign governments interfering with other countries' elections, the number one country in the world for doing that, by far, there's no one else even in number two, three, or four, there's only also receiving votes at the bottom, is the United States. We routinely interfere with other countries' domestic politics. My God, go to Venezuela now, or Ecuador, or Brazil, or Honduras, and talk to the people there, get the lay of the land there. We're all over their elections. We're participating, supporting one side, working against the other side. It's a routine process. So there isn't, and it's not just in Latin America, but that's the most obvious place. And so for the Americans to suddenly be getting sanctimonious and holier than thou on this interfering in elections, it's, it would be more convincing if the U.S. showed similar concern, or politicians and news media showed similar concern about our own involvement messing with domestic politics and elections in other countries. And then the other issue on that worth noting, and I think this has been mentioned only on the margins, there is one foreign government that we know actively engages in interfering with American domestic politics, and that's Israel. I mean, Israel is obsessed with American domestic politics and will do anything in its power to end the career of someone it sees as being hostile to Israel's interests. And since Israel is so dependent upon U.S. Military aid and money from Washington, that's probably the most important thing to do in Israel is to win American politics. So if we're going to take this, suddenly we're really concerned about foreign government's involvement, we ought to start with the cover. We're going to do this done 1,000 times more than Russia's ever dreamt of doing and go after what Israel's done before we go to the small fry.
That makes total sense. Bob, one thing I wanted to ask you, which I've never understood about this post-election furor of Russia, hacking the election. First off, that implies that they hacked the vote. There's no evidence of that. So instead, what we're actually talking about is emails, that were either leaks or hacks, and so it's questionable whether they're hacks. They could have been leaks. I totally agree with you that the germane point is the incredible embeddedness of the media with the Clinton candidacy. And the other key feature is the fact that the Podesta-Clinton campaign actually was looking for what they called a Pied Piper, someone to run against in the Republican side, someone whom they assessed incorrectly, Clinton could easily win against. And thus, they actually, you know, there's strategy memos that were revealed in the WikiLeaks that show that they promoted Donald Trump at the outset of his campaign for the Republican nomination to their media contacts, which sounds just like kind of a big nothing. Unless you read it together with the emails you're talking about, where you see how extensive those contacts are. And so, but the thing that I've never understood in all of this is, you know, what you and I are talking about is something that we're aware of. You know, we read the WikiLeaks. A certain narrow group of people did read the WikiLeaks. But the American population at large was not studying these and looking at this collusion. And what I don't understand is why, after the fact, the Democratic Party would be wanting to call the WikiLeaks to public attention through, you know, this accusation that this is what turned the election. I didn't observe that so many people were up at arms about this, that it played a substantive role in the election, although certainly there was a lot of kind of general din about it. But none of what we're discussing was even covered in the mainstream media. So, you know, the majority of people would not even have known about these damning things. Why did they want to bring this to public attention through pointing at the WikiLeaks emails as key to the lost election?
Well, that's a great question, and you're very well informed, too. I mean, I should have pointed out that the Clinton campaign and the DNC aggressively worked to promote and encourage their contacts at MSNBC, CNN, Washington Post, Politico, New York Times, to give attention to the Trump campaign, take it seriously. They thought they could disrupt the Republican side by getting Trump in there to goof it up. They thought he could never win the election. So the more he played a larger role in the Republican side, the more it would damage the Republican chances for success in November. As you pointed out, that was obviously an incorrect assessment. But I mean, it is really strikingly, probably the most direct intervention in the American election was what the Hillary Clinton campaign tried to do to the Republicans, as much as what the Russians did to anyone. And that, again, was not an issue they wanted emphasized, nor did the news media want to talk about how they were eating out of her food bowl when they went about, you know, Rachel Maddow and MSNBC basically became the Trump news network for much of 2015 while he was still polling poorly. It was a joke campaign. He was still a Pat Paulson type joke campaign in the summer of 2015 before his poll numbers rose. And Rachel Maddow gave him vastly more attention than she would give Bernie Sanders. At the same time, was drawing 20,000 people to unbelievable rallies around the country with no publicity whatsoever in the news media. And he was basically blacked out on the so-called liberal news channel. So your point there is well taken. I mean, I believe there's a couple reasons why the Clinton campaign in the fall of 2016 and the Democrats after the loss in November in 2016 have emphasized this. First of all, by saying, hey, the Russians are responsible for this before Election Day, it distracted attention away from the content of the emails. And the news media could say, yeah, let's talk about the Russians, rather than actually talk about the actual content of those emails, which they claimed the Russians had leaked and hacked and leaked. And so they had incentive to do that. And it was very successful at that, unless you were watching Fox News. And they of course, recorded it critically because they wanted to help Trump win. And that was just their sole motivation there. Since the election, I mean, I think this goes to a broader issue here, and this is a complex issue, which is that Hillary Clinton and much of the Democratic Party is very strongly committed to a policy, really it's a neocon policy, interestingly, revamping, recharging the Cold War, turning Russia into the archenemy of the world, certainly the United States and the free world. And this is a narrative that, you know, she's been working on for a few years, going back to when she was Secretary of State. And she has a lot of company, and John McCain and Lindsey Graham who are comfortable with this on the Republican side of the aisle. And in American political elites, there's just a real strong sense that we've got to go after Russia. They're the bad guys of the universe right now. And they're invoking a lot of the sort of the old Cold War hysteria, which is, of course, absurd. Russia today is not a communist country. It's not remotely close to communist ideology. It is, you know, a kleptocracy. It's a corrupt capitalist country, the sort of country we're normally very comfortable working with. My God, most of the countries around the world we deal with are like that, and we're increasingly like that ourselves. So, you know, it's someone we ought to be in good terms with. But for whatever reason, I think primarily because Russia does not want to be under the thumb of the U.S. and insists on a certain amount of independence, that pisses off people in power in Washington and the EU and NATO. See it as too much of a renegade and unreliable, and they don't like that. And they want to basically get it under their thumb.
You know, what you're describing here in terms of the embeddedness of the mainstream, aka liberal media, and the Clinton campaign, it's like there's been the minute the election happened, there were these suddenly a new meme developed. The meme was fake news, and the sense is, you know, there's real news, the news you can trust. We are it, and you know, we want to make clear who you should listen to, us. And then there's fake news, supposedly this new meme. You know, the bottom line is that there has been a loss of trust in the news media, with accusations flying in multiple directions as to, you know, who is the keeper of the flame of journalistic independence. And, you know, and people really don't know who to believe. If they go to their trusted mainstream sources that, you know, they followed this, I'm speaking of, you know, older generation people, midlife and beyond, that they followed for decades, you know, they find that they have the kinds of agendas you've described. And of course, then on the other hand, we have the right wing media, which has very strong agendas, with, you know, now Steve Bannon from Breitbart playing a critical role in the new administration. What is this fake news meme about, and what is actually going on in this incredibly divisive and, you know, untrustworthy news environment that we now are finding ourselves in? Are we just awakening to what has been true for a while, or is it actually, has it gotten worse, and is it going to get even worse than it now is with the president currently attacking the media?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of layers to answering the issues you just raised. It doesn't lend itself to a soundbite, unfortunately. But I think the place to start is to not regard this as just something that just happened in the last few months, and it's just some new phenomenon that came out of the blue and is associated with Russians or with Trump or with Fox News. But rather, I think the way to understand this is to go back one, two, three decades and understand that in the last 20 or 25 years, professional journalism in the United States, the fourth estate, has pretty much disintegrated and collapsed. It's crashed and burned. It barely exists compared to what existed 25 years ago. And as I say that, we have to understand that what existed at the peak of professional journalism, institutionally, say, in the second half of the 20th century into the 1980s and into the early 90s, was flawed in many respects. But for all its flaws, and we can talk about those later, it did have resources to do. A lot of people worked covering communities. There were a lot of reporters. If you went to the state capitol in Albany in New York or in Springfield in Illinois, you would find, you know, a couple dozen reporters covering what was going on there if they were in session and it was a news beat. And that was true all over the country. And, you know, journalism as we know it in terms of the resources covering communities, competing newsrooms and cities, that's all gone. There's barely any paid journalists anymore by comparison. The number of working reporters, and this includes new media, number of people getting paid a living to report on the news, to copy edit, to fact check, to be photojournalists is dramatically lower today than it was 25 or 30 years ago. And it's even more severe if you do it on a per capita basis, because the business model of commercial journalism has collapsed. It's, you know, crashed and burned. The advertising provided the vast majority of revenues paid for journalism in the United States at newspapers and broadcast news media. And advertising has come to learn that it no longer needs to do that to accomplish its commercial needs. It no longer has to bankroll journalism. And that's why newspapers have been completely hollowed out, because the advertisers have left. And then once the newspaper gets hollowed out, people stop buying it, and it just accelerates the decline. So that's the background. So there's a lot less journalism. So there's a lot less for people to sink their teeth into. I had friends of mine, for example, who moved out of Madison, where I live, Wisconsin, in the early 1970s or mid-1970s, and they moved back about 5 years ago after living on the East Coast. And they were just struck by how the local newspaper basically was just a shell of what had been in the 70s. And they said in the 70s, they used to just read the paper for like an hour every day. There was so much in it. Now they get it at their front door, and by the time they get to the kitchen table, they've read the only article in it that's not just a press release. And and I think that's true all across America, that we've seen this shriveling of journalism. And largely it's because media concentration made it possible for huge companies to gut newsrooms and get away with it, monopoly markets. And I've written a lot about that, and other people have as well. But also, it's the internet effect. In effect, advertisers now can go online and much more effectively locate their target audience. And by doing so, they no longer have to bankroll journalism or support media content of any kind. So they've fled supporting journalism. And what we're left with is far fewer reporters, editors, newsrooms than we had before, and it's only going to get worse. There's no reason to think it's going to turn around and get better. The commercial model is gone. So this is the background. Understand that the news media have been weakening dramatically, even as recently, I mean, it became noticeable, I think, in 2008. Friends of mine who were covering the presidential election and were, I had a friend who was actually covering the campaign, I think Obama's campaign or one of the campaigns, you might have been the Republican side or switching back and forth. And he said you were at the presidential press plane that would travel with the candidates, and there was far fewer working reporters on these planes than there had been in previous years. This is the presidential race. This is about the only thing they care about covering. Friends of mine who've run for Congress in Wisconsin, for U.S. Senate, for example, said that in the 1980s and 90s, when you'd run for office, there'd be journalists covering you all wherever you went, traveling with you across the state. By 2010, basically, you're on your own. There's no journalism covering you. So this is the backdrop, the end of journalism. As you know, there's just not much political journalism. What there is superficial and idiotic as a rule. So you're in a situation that there's not much there, so it lends itself to a weakening of the whole notion of a critical fourth estate, a free press, and it opens the door to what this we've evolved into, which is a more partisan journalism. Now, this is a long answer, Allison, so I'm glad. Thank you for bearing with me. Let's put Fox News and MSNBC in the context of this collapse. The genius of Fox News, the business genius of Fox News, when Roger Ailes and Rupert Murdoch began it, say, 20 years ago, as a network, wasn't that they said, hey, we're just going to be the talking points of the Republican Party. We're going to be the Republican Pravda. And so anyone who's a Republican will watch us, and that's a really lucrative market, so we'll make a lot of money. What they realized was, in an environment where you can't afford to have any journalists, where very few little people do actually any reporting, if you've got to have a position, an attitude, or else no one has a reason to watch you. So they just sit around and they pay a few celebrity blowhards like O'Reilly and Hannity to pontificate. And if they pontificate, they've got to have an opinion. They've got to have a political edge to make it worth watching. If you just pontificate, don't do any journalism, you claim you're neutral, no one has a reason to watch you because you're not going to learn anything. And that was the whole genius of Fox News, was understanding that they could basically do no journalism but make a fortune doing a news channel, so they just gave opinions, right-wing opinions. And similarly, MSNBC, which actually has the resources of NBC News to draw upon, not too dissimilar. They, you know, friends of mine go on those shows in the past at some frequency. And it's not like they have big newsrooms covering stories there. They basically rely on, you know, Rachel Maddow sees a good story in the morning paper or somewhere else or online, and she draws from that to do her own work maybe or write an essay or have a guest on. But they're not covering stuff. They're basically just producers and celebrities. And they're more, they've learned that they have to pitch their stuff to their target audience, which they deem as the mainstream Democrats. That's who's going to watch them, and they're going to give that worldview. And CNN has gravitated more or less in that direction. They try to play it down the middle, but the right wing has made that awfully hard for them to do. So they play it much more to the Democratic Party as well. And but when you don't do journalism, you're sort of forced into that. You've got to pick a side because you're not actually covering anything. You have nothing else to report on except gossip from your side versus the other side.
That's what, you know, it's like horse race politics. So it's really, it's like there are certain issues, if they don't fit into that, because both, you know, both the corporate-funded Republicans and the corporate-funded Democrats are, you know, taking money from the fossil fuel industry and it's creating a problem with climate or whatever, you know, the story becomes the one side denying it and the other side admitting it, but not really reporting on it to any great extent, where people are going to become activated about it and push for change, push for action in a way that would imperil the donors, the oil industry donors, to both sides. So therefore, that's not a good topic for, you know, the horse race mentality or anything like the TPP, where you had, you know, the future-oriented trade deals that may be coming down the line, where, you know, basically the Wall Streeters from both sides are kind of holding hands under the table, and therefore there's no incentive for anyone to cover that as an issue. But if it's something that makes, you know, gives the other side a black eye, or where they're clearly different, you know, if one side is bigoted and the other is more inclusive or tries to position themselves to look that way, then you have a story. And so there's a huge swath of things that get omitted, you know.
I think you're right. But I put it as that there's just not a whole lot of investigative journalism of really going into how people in power operate, how people who want to get in power have operated, so citizens can understand what's going on, what the various positions are. And so what passes for news is if you're on Fox, you're just going to be fed talking points against Democrats and favoring Republicans. You're on NBC, it's more or less the opposite. Now, I think MSNBC at times does some great work, Fox less often, but occasionally it does some decent work. But it's always seen through partisan eyes, and much of it is just gossip. It's just regurgitating the talking points of the political figures in each side. And so the reason why this is important is that, you know, when someone says fake news, like Donald Trump says, well, the news media that's critical of me is fake news, you know, it's not entirely a hollow claim. I mean, it's to when Donald Trump was saying that MSNBC is in the pocket of Hillary Clinton, you know, it wasn't just Republicans who believed that. Bernie Sanders supporters said, darn right, he's absolutely right. We were there through the campaign when Chris Hayes and Rachel Maddow and Chris Matthews were basically just serving up whatever the, you know, inside talk of the Hillary Clinton campaign was and their coverage of Bernie Sanders. So they felt that. So it resonated that it was partisan. And so for Americans to hear that the other side they don't like is just fake news, well, there's an element of truth there. It's not like you can say, no, there's a body of critical independent researcher journalism that treats everyone the same. And in fact, what we have left in America today, the best journalism that basically treats both sides the same, that, you know, basically holds both Republicans and Democrats in power to the same standard, is coming from people like Glenn Greenwald at The Intercept. Who's every bit as critical of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama for the stuff he was critical of George W. Bush. Now, MSNBC and Fox News never would hold them to the same standard. You know, they have a partisan worldview entirely. Amy Goodman at Democracy Now, same standard for Democrats and Republicans. You know, and that's what real journalism ought to do, the same standard for everyone. And the same standard for the U.S. government and the Russian government. You don't say our government is automatically the good guy, and so we take their word and trust them, and we don't trust someone else. You hold everyone to the same demand for evidence and truth. I mean, that's what honest journalism does, period. It's not always fun, and it's all very often extremely unpopular, especially with people in power. But that's why you have a free press. And we don't have much of that. And what we do have is increasingly the sort of hollowed out gossip and partisanship. So when the Trump administration comes along now to get to the very important and frightening moment we're in today in the United States, and says, hey, everyone, all the New York Times and all these articles criticizing us and showing what frauds we are and how hypocritical we are and how we're lying, this is all fake news, don't pay any attention. I think they're entirely misbased in their criticism. It's outrageous. It's obscene the way they're attacking the press rather than dealing with the actual issues. But at the same time, the press has been so hollowed out, it can work in a way that would have been laughable 10 or 20 or 30 years, especially 30 years ago.
So, there's a kernel of truth in what he's saying, and he's also trying to basically dismantle the other side while build a media and influence empire on the right-wing side to rationalize and sustain all, the corporate overrule that is coming full force in with his administration. So that's not a good situation either.
I think let's talk about that point if we can. I don't mean to interrupt you, but I think this is such a central point that you're making. What Donald Trump, his attitude towards political dissent, towards the truth, towards journalism, towards democratic institutions is frightening. I mean, there's no other word for it. It's appalling. He is, towards criticism of him, he's like a thin-skinned dictator. I mean, he's simply can't deal with even criticism of him. He has no sense of humor, as far as we can tell. It's really quite striking. He really does not have the temperament to be a leader by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, Lyndon Baines Johnson used to take unbelievable criticism during the Vietnam War for his war policies. I mean, abuse and contempt and in the public from demonstrations whenever he tried to speak. But when he left office, he actually, he was charitable towards his critics. I mean, he understood that was part of the process. Most politicians do. They come up through a system where they understand that part of being in politics, you're going to have a lot of people who really don't like you. You're going to have journalists sometimes being unfair to you in your opinion, but you've got to accept it and deal with it. That's just part of how the thing works. And he never went through that system. He just came out of reality television and public relations and surrounding himself with sycophants. And so he's just totally unprepared for that world. Now, that world might be crumbling, but it's still an important world to have. So we don't abandon it. We strengthen it. And so he's a uniquely unqualified person to be a leader, a democratic leader. Similarly, what you see with Trump, it's frightening, is that, there's just not a sense that he has a whole lot of respect for democratic institutions or practices in what he's doing. I mean, it's very much an authoritarian mindset that he and his Breitbart buddy has as they sort of map out their plans for the country. And that, is, again, I think is alarming. And the complete disregard for the truth, the willingness to just lie brazenly and then just ignore it when called on it. And if they're called on too often, just call it fake news. I think these are things that are beyond unsettling, and I think they should be alarming to anyone.
What is the pushback other than, I don't know. It's like how, on the one hand, you now have CNN and MSNBC and all of those guys are mobilized against the horrible things that he's doing. But on the other hand, where are they pointing toward a solution, and how can the opposition function? If they're going to point back toward the sort of failed Democratic Party, with all of its problems, with no self-diagnosis, no self-assessment, just, sort of a retrenchment going on, how can we, have an effective opposition, and where will it come from, given that kind of media setup?
Well, I would say in terms of just news media and, you know, what we need from a news media right now that would be effective more than what we're getting is, you know, there's clearly Trump is the center of everything. And so every article is based off of Trump and his pronouncements and his indeed frightening phenomenon. But if you watch that press conference a couple of weeks ago that Trump did, it was sort of utterly surreal and bizarre press conference. What was striking about it was that a lot of it was about sort of Trump's talk about fake news and sort of outrageous charges that he's made and his complete inability to tell the truth or disregard for the truth lack of concern for when he's caught lying. It's like, okay, next, you know, it's like, who cares? That's just fake news if you're criticizing me. But what we need right now more than anything is a hard look at what is actually going on that Trump is doing on issues like in that press conference, the only one journalists have had. There was not one question, to my knowledge, and I watched it pretty closely, about climate change and what he's doing to the environment, the contempt he has for science. This is the sort of stuff people ought to be hearing about and knowing about. This is stuff he needs to be held accountable for, his climate policies. Trump ran for president and probably got elected, in fact. In fact, I guarantee he got elected, in fact, he's going to drain the swamp and get rid of the corruption in Washington. And his critique was much more of corporate power. He was actually almost Bernie Sanders-like at times in his criticism of corporate interests dominating Washington. So he's going to drain the swamp. But in fact, he's drained the swamp and filled the ocean. I mean, he's taken corruption to levels that Warren Harding couldn't have fantasized about. I mean, basically it's open grab bag season of crony capitalism now under Trump. And this would be what the journalists should be talking about. I mean, I think they need to really hammer that home. Do their job. That's the work we need. And we don't have enough reporters to cover this enough. It's really, this is where our crisis is hitting us home. It's not 1973 when there were 50 newsrooms in Washington with full of reporters could go out and cover these sorts of stories. And if one of them started it, another one would continue with it. Now we're down to basically just a few newsrooms that have paid reporters who can cover this. We're all overworked. There's stories that are just slipping through the cracks right and left. And we're left with citizen journalists doing the best they can. The citizen journalist is sort of a code name for unpaid journalists. And unpaid journalists can only do so much till they have to eat.
Yeah, that's really true. And
also, unpaid journalists aren't respected. I mean, journalism needs to be respected and feared by those in power. And Trump clearly doesn't fear the news media because he knows they're weak now and they're immobile and they're discredited and disliked across the spectrum. So he doesn't have to take them as seriously or fear them like Richard Nixon had to fear the news media or any free society, any leader should fear a press system.
That really makes a lot of sense. What resources do you think for a comeback from that? What would be the best case scenario of where new strengths could come from, in from this? I mean, if you could wave a magic wand, what could we recreate? I mean, for example, do people need to pony up and fund their favorite sites more? What is going to happen in this context? I mean, one of the things that I see happening is, there are always new rounds of people in the citizen journalist side who are kind of coming in to be the next round of reporters. So when, because it's hard to do consistently in the economic context that we're talking about. I mean, it really is. And also, there's been, I think, a radical switch of positioning since the election where, all the news is like Trump this, Trump that, Trump, 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 Trump. And also for the readers, I mean, he's coming at the changes that he's instituting so rapidly that I think people are horrified, overwhelmed. At some point, they're going to, be kind of wiped out. I mean, who's going to lead the charge? Who's going to lead the resistance? What's the best, initiatives or energies or, you know, coming people or group of people coming in that can kind of serve as a fulcrum for all of this?
Well, that's a mouthful for 10 mouths right there to deal with the issues you raise again, Al. So I would say that at one level, independent of media specifically or per se, there is, you know, the whole political question of how democratic resistance to these authoritarian impulses is going to take place. What's going to happen? And I think clearly in the United States, and this is true because this is really a global phenomenon now, these sort of ultra-right-wing authoritarian governments coming into power. I think that what's necessary are grassroots political movements and resistance, and the sort of resistance we haven't seen probably in decades in this country for the most part, going back to the 60s and before that, the 40s and 30s, from people who are just not going to take it anymore and refuse to see this country's democratic institutions crumble. And I think we're going to see more of that, and not just the United States, but worldwide. And I think that, you know, one of the things that's striking right now is that there's much more activism in this country in this period, and it's been growing for some time now, than there's been in a very long time in this country. This is a very different country today than it was in 1996 or 2001 or 1983. I mean, it's really, the apathy and apolitical nature, which is so carefully cultivated by those in power in this country to keep people on their couches and stoned, that is not the rule of the day. I mean, there's a lot of that still. We're still a largely depoliticized society, but the ice is melting, and we're seeing a lot more activism because politics is no longer a consumer good. It's not a hobby. It's a matter of survival. And that it takes on an entirely different air in that context, both economically, socially, environmentally. These aren't issues that are just, you know, maybe actually care about them. It's like they're in your face. You care about them or you die. And that's the moment we're in for a lot of this. And so that's going to happen. And how that plays out is, you know, the central story of what's going to happen in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years. Now, at the same time, I think the media question, the journalism question, which is I've dealt with a lot, how do we solve this crisis of journalism? Is one I've written about at great length, and it is not just a U.S. problem, it's a global problem. The economic issues I described here are taking place across the world to varying degrees. Now, some countries, they seem less pressing because they have very strong, well-funded public broadcasting systems that provide a lot of journalism that sort of keep the floor from going too low. And this is in Northern Europe, Germany, Scandinavia, Britain. But, you know, they still feel it, too. And in fact, I'll be in both England and Scotland talking at Parliament in London and then up in Edinburgh and then going to Norway in April to talk about the crisis in journalism. So these countries are dealing with it. They're seeing the collapse of working coverage online or in old media, and they understand it's a public policy issue. And they understand that leaving it to the market has shown it won't happen. Capitalists can't make money doing journalism. They stopped doing it for the most part, and they're not coming back. They have no economic incentive. So if we're going to have journalism, it's like education. It's going to be something that's a public policy is going to have to make it possible. And so that's the solution there. We're going to have to do something to make the resources for an independent, uncensored, competitive journalism exist. Now, what's interesting, Allison, and I don't know if we've ever talked about this in the show before, because I've been working on this for quite some time, there's actually a very rich history in the United States dealing with exactly this problem. In fact, you even go a step further and say at the beginning of this country, one of the core issues the framers of the Constitution and the founders of this country dealt with was how to have an independent press. And at that time, no one thought it was possible to say, hey, let's hope some rich people can make money publishing newspapers and they'll luck out. That was unthinkable for the first 100 years of American history. Instead, it was understood by everyone from George Washington and John Adams on the right to Madison and Jefferson in the center or center left over to the real left of Ben Franklin and then on to Tom Paine. That if you wanted to have a free press and a credible journalism, it would require massive subsidies. And that's what we created at the beginning of the country, huge postal subsidies. So the newspapers basically were distributed for free. The cost of distribution was borne by the government by basically distributing newspapers at virtually no cost. And all newspapers are distributed by the mails for the first 50 years of American history. So that was done consciously for that. 90% of the traffic of the post office in the 19th century, weighted traffic, was newspapers. That's what it did. It was just the Postmaster General was the newspaper distributor of America. He was the distribution director for all American newspapers, in effect. And so it was a huge subsidy, intentionally done to make it easier for people to publish newspapers, to reduce the cost and to spawn an independent, competitive press. We need to think that way again. We've got to understand journalism as a public good, not as something we just have to hope someone can get rich doing it and we get lucky. And if we do that, it's really not a difficult problem to solve, but we've got to get our head around it the right way to solve it. And I think that's a lot of what my work has been on, a lot of the work I'm doing now. And that's where a lot of the politics of how we come up with an independent, uncensored press system is about. And we can go into more into that if you want, or we can go back to the top of your call.
Well, no, actually, I'd like to hear more about that. I'd like to hear about what you're doing and where initiatives could be happening. Because, you know, in my estimation, you know, without a solid and independent press and without being able to tackle the Citizens United problem of having bought politicians, you know, we lose a lot of leverage for making any kind of change within the government. So, yeah, I'd like to hear more about that.
Sure. Well, the primary, I think that there's a public policy solution. You know, journalism is something society desperately needs, but the market won't provide in sufficient quality or quantity, much like education. That's why it's a public good. And so the government had did huge subsidies in the first century of American history. And then when the market came in and advertising emerged to sort of provide the money, that it became much more of a commercial system. And that's what we've had through the 20th century. And it had its strengths and it had its weaknesses, but that system is now dying and it's not coming back. So what do we do to get the resources back so we have independent, uncensored journalism, but we have accountable journalism, people who cover stuff, who are competing with other journalists, who have fact checkers, copy editors, so the quality is good, who are accountable for what they do. And, you know, there's probably any number of ways to do this, but one of the ones I've been attracted to, and I think I'd like to see more discussion of, and it's getting the international attention. It was really developed initially by two brothers, Dean Baker, a very well-known economist, and his brother Randy. And they came up with an idea about 10 or 15 years ago of some sort of news voucher. And I've embellished it and played with it a lot, so the other people have as well. But the core principle is this. What you desperately need is you need public funding of journalism, or it won't exist. You know, the market won't support it. But you don't want the government to control the content. Well, that's more or less, those are the two big things you want to accomplish. And so the way you do it is you give every American a voucher. Everyone 18 years old or older gets $200 of government money they can give to any nonprofit, non-commercial news medium. Their choice. And they don't have to give it to anyone if they want. They can just elect not to do that. And the government keeps the money. But they can do $200. And the only catch is that whatever nonprofit, non-commercial news media that accepts this $200 grant from anyone, they can't run advertising. They can't be part of a commercial operation. And whatever they produce with that money has to be made available for free on the Internet. It goes immediately to the public domain.
That's great.
So the public pays for it, but everyone gets access to it. And the principle is that if every American adult did that over 18, it'd be like a $40 billion subsidy or something. But you would then have, like, community radio stations, local websites and communities go around and try to get people in their community to give them some of their $200, and they would have to produce, and people didn't like what they were seeing from who they gave their voucher to. The next year, they'd give it to someone else. So you'd have competition. It'd be nonprofit, non-commercial. There'd be ample funding. I mean, let's say Amy Goodman got, you know, a million people to give her their $200. So that's $200 million. So you would have the world, you know, a world-class newsroom times 10, then that wouldn't happen. But that's the sort of resources we're talking about. So I don't know what city you live in, Allison, but I, you know, if you lived in a city of 500,000 people and you thought you were getting a lousy journalism, you got 10,000 people to give you their news vouchers. Well, suddenly, you know, you're looking at pretty serious money, 200 times 10,000. What's that? $2 million, $20 million, $20 million bucks. You can have a nice newsroom at $20 million. And so that's the sort of policies we need to be talking about, things like that. And the way you prevent corruption is that they have to meet basic IRS codes for being nonprofit, non-commercial, which already exists. It's not like you have to invent something new. And, you know, there's probably going to be some people who, there are ways to prevent fraud, and, you know, you'll find ways to do it. But it's something you start with and you work with and see if that can solve the problem. Maybe not the best solution, there might be others, but that's the sort of thing we need to be discussing. Because if we don't start talking about those sort of solutions and debating them and fine-tuning them and experimenting at the local level with them, and we just sit around waiting for some millionaire to say, I can get rich doing really good journalism, the evidence is in. It's going to be a long wait. And I don't think we can afford to wait much longer because it's a lack of journalism that gets us in a situation like we have now where we have a president of the United States who basically is a fraud.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I was really also just interested in your analysis of the president in terms of his, you know, experience and having a character and nature that could withstand the kind of give and take and pummeling and criticism and everything that comes along with occupying a position of leadership and power. You know, to me, that was a very, how shall I say that? It was unique in the descriptions of the president that are critical of him that I've heard, because most often people are going down the rabbit hole of discussing, you know, his psychological profile or their interpretation of it, but without reference to the office per se. It's almost as if there's part of the whole entertainment factor in the media and, you know, with celebrities and everything else is that we all become kind of gossips about the lack within the president rather than analysts of the policy implications and historical implications of his characterological makeup. And so I just want to comment, because there's a lot of, you know, gossip about, or, you know, the most common meme that one hears about him on the side of people who don't care for him is that he's crazy, you know, for example, which I dislike because it basically is like venting. It you know, it doesn't tell you anything. It doesn't assess anything. It's just kind of venting or creating something that people can kind of go tisk tisk and, you know, all agree on and shake their heads. It deals with the many fears and worries and negative emotions that many people feel, in looking at him and what's evolving. Whereas, you know, I think even just in that one remark, it's the job of a journalist, you just, you know, modeled it perfectly, to be a little bit more analytic so that instead of just being immersed or emotionally drenched in the problem, we have some basis for assessment that gives us a path to correcting a problem. You know, in a different way. I mean, what, you know, if we just call him crazy, for example, what are we going to do? Bring in a shrink and request that they analyze him? I mean, that's not going to help. He's not going to agree to that. So I just want to highlight what it is
And if I can add to that, Alice, I would say that, you know, Trump did not win because he's, you know, got a weird personality, whether he's crazy or not, or that he's thin-skinned. He won in a way that would have been unthinkable because really both political parties are in crisis. I mean, their whole system is in crisis. So a number of people were just so fed up, they were really saying, I'm going to vote for this guy because screw it. I just don't like the mainstream Republicans. He ran against Republicans, mind you, as much as Democrats, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was just as critical of Republicans in his primary. That's what his appeal was. He was different from the rest of the people in the clown car. And he was also not a Democrat. And I think that this gets back to an earlier question you make, that when we had all this discussion now, Russians stealing the election, that sort of stuff also sort of helps the Democrats avoid the very difficult question they don't want to deal with, which is, why is the Democratic Party, why didn't it win a landslide? Why did it lose this election? Demographically, the Democratic Party should never lose a national election in this country demographically, the way the country has changed. And in fact, Hillary Clinton actually won by popular vote by 2 million votes, so she actually didn't lose, only in the sort of crazy electoral college scam system we have did she lose. But she should have still won going away. She never should have lost Wisconsin or Michigan or Pennsylvania. That's ridiculous that someone like Trump would win those states. And what Democrats, they'd rather blame Russia or blame fake news or blame anyone but themselves. Look in the mirror and say, what's wrong with the Democratic Party? Where have we failed? Why aren't we commanding the respect that people should be voting for us? And that's a discussion that we're not having now. That's a discussion you're not getting on MSNBC or CNN. Fox News is incapable of it because they don't understand anything over there about Democrats except that they don't like them. And that's a discussion that really you're only going to get from the Glenn Greenwalds periodically. There's an excellent book by one of my favorite writers, Tom Frank, called mm-hmm. Listen Liberal, which came out before mm-hmm. the election, but really more than anything captures why Hillary Clinton lost, which is basically about how the Democratic Party is the party now increasingly of the top 10%. That's her base. It's, the party's base is affluent professionals. And they through and through abandoned the working class. And the trade deals were sort of the classic example of that, all these trade deals, where they just threw the working class in this country under the bus. And Hillary Clinton was really sort of the poster child of the Democratic Party that, because she was a fervent supporter of all these trade deals, aggressively pushed them. She called the TPP the gold standard for trade deals when she was Secretary of State. And then when she's running for office, she says, well, now I'm opposing it, like Obama opposed it in 2008. But no one believed that. Even her own people didn't believe that. I mean, they knew as soon as she got in office, she'd be in favor of it. But she was just posturing to get votes, because that's what you have to say to get working class votes in Wisconsin, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. But those voters, eventually, they're not dumb. They understand what's going on. They see that. And So they've got to come to grips with what they actually stand for, what they are. Are they just a money laundering system for billionaires and hedge fund dudes who basically mm-hmm. use identity politics to win elections and fear of Republicans to win elections, but don't really do much else, except they're not quite as bad as Republicans? Well, that has opened the door to something that's far worse than even Republicans, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, brilliantly said and very true. I mean, my reporting over the last year was all about how Clinton, if Clinton ceded the trade deals critique to Trump, she would lose. And it was seen by all of the mainstream Democratic friends and followers as, why am I criticizing her when Trump is so bad? And, the ability to take any kind of corrective, because I've been covering the deals for about 3 or 4 years, mm-hmm. The ability to self-reflect is not strong. And, we really are nearing the end of the show here, but that's also something that an independent press should help. It is our role to help people do that and to point to where, there are gaps in what politicians are doing or the ways that we're thinking of it. It is our job to do that and to so that there is some self-reflection that leads to change rather than the assumption that it's all entrenched and stuck and nothing can move, which in fact seemed to be the case on the Clinton side, sadly, and there were missed opportunities there for those, so some self-reflection, really is required. Anyway, we're kind of down to the end of our time here, but it's been a joy once again, Bob, to have you joining the show here. And so, you know, hope this voucher thing works out. Full speed ahead on that one. And, you know, we'll keep in touch about, because this whole you know, uprising and kind of volatility in the media landscape is something that we've never seen before, and it's going to continue playing out. But I think your proposal is something that could create some stability, someplace where people could go for trustworthy reporting. Thank you for being with me today on Connect the Dots, and thank you for your work.
My great pleasure. My pleasure, Allison. Good luck with the show, and I look forward to being back in the future.
Oh, that's great. Thank you. And thank you, listeners, for being with me today in Connect the Dots with Bob McChesney. Check out his latest books. And tell us your title again, Bob, for the new one.
People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy.
Brilliant. Thank you for your prescient work. Thank you, listeners, for being with us today and Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Chin up, keep going forward. I'm Allison Rose Levy.
There was pink, but there was the sky.